This is the Human Rights 2020s podcast from the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. This episode is the first in a series of four recordings taken from an event called What Went Wrong? COVID-19, Accountability and Building Back Better, held on the 17th of May 2021. This is a recording of the keynote speech made by Adam Wagner, human rights lawyer and founder and chair of Each Other.
Really delighted to have Adam Wagner come speak to us this morning, who is a human rights lawyer. He's a founder and chair of Each Other and was a specialist advisor to the Joint Committee on Human Rights Inquiry around COVID-19. Adam, I'm delighted to hand over to you now.
Thanks so much, Mary. It's all good for me. I'm really pleased to be here, and I'm honoured to be giving the keynote today. And my only regret is that I can't be there in person, wherever there is. But certainly every time I've come to Edinburgh to talk about human rights, it's been a real pleasure. It's a real human rights positive place, which I think contrasts very much to where I'm based in London, where it feels like you're really just sort of running on the spot just to keep the protections that we have, let alone improve them. And I think whenever I go to Edinburgh, or in fact to Cardiff or to Belfast, it's such a different feeling. And hopefully very soon we'll be able to do this in person. Has there been sufficient attention paid to human rights during the pandemic? And actually what I'm going to try and do over the next 20 minutes is maybe try and ask that question at the very least, and maybe even start answering it. I have to admit, I found this preparation for this talk more difficult than I usually do for the very many COVID talks that I've given over the past year and a bit. Because I guess I feel like I'm not quite ready to surface from this this year and a half nearly of worrying and thinking and obsessing to an extent over what's been going on relating to human rights and COVID. I often talk about there being three aspects to a human rights society. You can't have a human rights society without these three aspects, and they are that human rights is embedded in culture, in institutions and in law. And I think sometimes we think with our, from wherever perspective we're coming from, that the focus has to be on one thing or the other. If only we can get these great human rights laws in place, finally, we will have a human rights society. But the reality is that it doesn't work like that. You need human rights embedded across society. And that's what the approach I've tried to take to human rights and COVID. I've been working with culture, I've written countless articles. I've been out doing whatever radio show or TV program will have me on, banging on about human rights and COVID, about lawmaking, about the people being discriminated against, about the vaccine passports, whatever the latest issue is. I've been working with the Joint Committee on Human Rights, as Mary mentioned. We've worked on five reports together. It's been an amazing experience. I've never done that role before, working so closely with the Parliamentary Committee. But we talk about this, the importance of accountability through the public inquiry, which will hopefully now be coming in the spring. But there have, in fact, I think, been over 50 parliamentary inquiries running live during the pandemic, including one at the Joint Committee on Human Rights, which has produced, I think, 8 reports over the course of just over a year, and 5 of which I worked on. So I've been working in the institutional side, but also consistently on the legal side, with trying to get the courts interested in COVID-related human rights issues, which is a lot harder than you might think, because the courts are incredibly worried about getting involved in what they see as political issues. And it's been very, very difficult. In fact, the only real judgment of note that has found a significant breach of human rights obligations during COVID has been up in Scotland, in the religious services ban ruling, which is extremely important. But I'll talk a little bit about that too. I think this question, what went wrong, is so difficult when you're still really in the thing that is going wrong or the thing that is happening. And it's very hard to see outside of the immediate concerns, you know, the variants of concern, vaccine passports, whatever, hotel quarantine, whatever the issue that's coming up at this moment. It's very difficult to step back. That's, I think, why I found this quite a difficult talk to think through. And what I thought would be useful on the being at the start of this day, where we're all going to be thinking about this through the day, is just to throw out some ideas and some issues, maybe say things that might be a bit controversial, particularly about our own, as a human rights community, response to the pandemic. And then I'm just going to look at three things and answer three questions. The first one is what lens? The second one is what happened? And the third one is what went wrong? And I don't think you can get to the third one without looking at the first two. What do I mean by what lens? Well, one of the things that I've really noticed during the course of this pandemic, working with many, many people in the human rights community, is there are many different lenses, or there are at least a few different lenses through which you can consider these issues from a human rights perspective. And depending on which lens you use, you might come to quite significantly different conclusions, and maybe conclusions that are not compatible with each other. So, for example, if you look at what's happened through a civil and political rights lens, you might see the lockdowns as the key issue, on the key impact on personal freedom, as in lockdowns are effectively taking away personal freedoms that we can never get back. And you might get to a conclusion that in actual fact, no matter how dangerous a virus, it would never be justified. It has never been justified to lock us in our houses, to take away some of the most fundamental freedoms that we have. You might get to, and then you get to the sort of newspaper headlines, in fact, that I was looking at this morning, freedom at risk from Indian variant, as if the Indian variant is the sort of, you know, the anti-human rights actor in this picture that's coming along to take our freedoms. You could then, you know, flip that round. If you start from a social and health rights lens, you can come to quite a different conclusion. You might see lockdowns as a sort of necessary evil that are required to save life, this idea that there is a balance between lives and livelihoods is a mistake. It's the wrong paradigm. It's a category error. If that's the right expression, it doesn't actually make sense, because unless you lock down hard and early, you will lose both lives and livelihoods. And there's nothing you can do about it once the virus enters your population. And I think one of the things that I've really benefited from is discussing. I run a podcast called the Better Human Podcast, and it's almost entirely, well, I mean, probably two-thirds of the episodes in the past year and a bit have been focused on COVID. I've done countless interviews with all sorts of people coming from different perspectives, across that spectrum. And I've really benefited from hearing from some colleagues who understand this from different perspectives, and certainly different to mine. I just want to read you, just talking about my perspective, I want to read something that I wrote at the end of March last year. In the New Statesman. It's a bit of a long quote, but I just want to give you a sense of where I was coming from at the beginning. In the three decades between 1915 and 1945, the world experienced a flu pandemic which killed 50 million people, the Great Depression, two world wars, and mass genocides. Whilst our current crisis is undoubtedly severe, in terms of the effect on public health and personal freedom, we are thankfully not yet approaching the misery of the 20th century. Chaos is by definition unpredictable. It's easy, however, to predict how our societies respond to it. We put up walls, close in on ourselves, and turn on each other. The modern human rights framework was established after the Second World War precisely because people witnessed how fragile liberal democratic societies are when faced with existential crises. In 1949, Pierre-Henri Tijen, a French resistance fighter and founder of the European Convention on Human Rights, said that personal freedom set of personal freedom that European citizens had become used to it as the air they breathed, with the result they did not perhaps esteem it highly enough. So when fascism and communism descended, they found us relaxed, skeptical and unarmed. Europe needed a war and for some enemy occupation to, quote, make us realize afresh the value of humanism. Thankfully, we're not at war, but the COVID-19 pandemic has touched each and every one of us already, whether through illness, death, or an unsettling impression that our personal freedoms are being eroded, even if for a good cause, to save life. The very fabric of our society, woven from our ability to gather and socialize in physical proximity, is becoming frayed by enforced isolation. Each time we leave the house, there seems to be a new restriction and an ever-increasing atmosphere of unease and mistrust. That's the similarity. The authors of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other key human rights treaties understood the danger of the breakdown of social structures and the steady erosion of individual liberties in the face of a crisis and in the name of emergency powers. The wisdom of Tijan's approach, along with other founders such as the Conservative Home Secretary, David Maxwell Fyfe, a Scot, I must add, was to distill the essence of human dignity into a set of fundamental rights, which would ultimately be agreed by most of the world's states through the Universal Declaration and the European Convention. Without these rights, we're not wholly human and cannot flourish. Today, they can act as a safety net, a checklist to place against our response to even the gravest crises. COVID-19 is a genuine emergency. It's also one which human rights treaties anticipated, partly through their proximity to the Spanish flu and other pandemics. The right to life is fundamentally important, as is the right to health contained in the International Covenant of Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. The right to liberty in the European Convention allows for exceptions in order to control the spread of infectious diseases, as do the rights to privacy, free speech, and freedom of religion. Human rights laws were not frozen in the 1940s, but have evolved into a sophisticated check and balance for the modern state. They developed a set of analytical tools which are well suited to calibrating responses to emergencies. A pandemic generates precisely the kind of instability and fear which has historically fanned the flames of illiberalism. As Tijan said, evil progresses cunningly. It's also important to remember we have a responsibility to look out for each other during a crisis. Contrary to the popular understanding, the Universal Declaration makes clear that humans have duties to the community. As Eleanor Roosevelt observed, human rights begin in the small places close to home. In times of social distancing, human rights principles, by focusing on empathy and common ground, can bring us closer together. In the UK, our liberal democracy has more or less remained liberal and democratic through immense crises. But that is thanks to the vigilance of those like Tijan, who view every suppression of freedom with healthy skepticism. Those skeptics tend to be unpopular, cast as irritating gadflies thwarting strong leadership, but we swap them at our peril. Parliament had, and I'm speaking here at the end of March last year, just passed the Coronavirus Act with an enormous increase in state power, swiftly followed by emergency regulations produced in hours, giving the police the right to prevent people leaving their houses without a reasonable excuse. Now more than ever, we need to resist our natural inclination to uncritically back assertive actions which protect us from danger. We must constructively engage, critique, and ensure that as soon as material facts no longer support restrictions on particular rights, the restrictions end there. Human rights principles and laws are tools which are designed for precisely this moment. We should not be afraid to use them. So I wrote that a year and 6 weeks ago. It seems like 100 years ago now. But looking back on that, I think that the as I said at the beginning, this idea of what lens you're looking through is so important. And I think, you know, there's certain things I would have put in with more detail if I was doing this again. Particularly, I've become a lot more knowledgeable and understanding of the right to health and the real crux of social rights. And I've spent quite a lot of time thinking about the background to the World Health Organization and some of the international health regulations which come out of the World Health Organization. But also I've come to appreciate that the World Health Organization is part of a peace with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, founded in the same year, it has at its heart a human rights approach to health. It is part, you cannot have one without the other. And I think it's a mistake to think you can have civil and political rights without social rights. I mean, I've come very strongly to that opinion through this year. But I think one of the issues for, I've noted for human rights advocates, for myself, but for many others, is that this crisis has almost been too big to understand from a human rights perspective, that it's been so relentless, you know, issue by issue. Well, I think we're used as the human rights community is used to dealing with particular issues, not making the grand society-wide statements of principle and values that you see coming out of the political sphere. We're much more sort of crisis mode sort of people. Let's deal with the issues we see on the ground. And these kind of COVID is one of those world events, which doesn't come along very often. I think I'd say it's not even once in a generation, where something turns the world upside down and allows us to see things in a different way. It's almost like a flash of lightning on a dark landscape, where all of a sudden you see what the world really looks like, and things change at the same time. And it's very, very difficult to get your head around that and to react to that in a way which doesn't just fit onto your existing way of viewing the world. It doesn't just continue whatever you've been thinking beforehand. It's natural for us to fall back on our pre-existing notions of how the world works and not really respond to this. But I think as the human rights community, there is a real opportunity here to see things in a different way, and also an opportunity to speak to people who weren't listening before. And I'll come back to that. My second question is, what happened? I think one of the problems with answering this question of what went wrong, and one of the reasons why I and many of you see the public inquiry is so important, is we don't have a settled understanding of what happened. This has been such a society-wide event that we're only just starting to understand what happened on the ground. How did this impact on people? You know, how did this society-changing event change society? How did it, who won and who lost? Who has been left at the bottom? Who has risen to the top? You know, what structures have changed? Where is the power balance settled? These questions are not clear to me at all. But I think, you know, I've just picked out 10 issues, which I think are absolutely crucial to understand from a human rights perspective. One which I've focused on a lot this year is emergency laws. And I think the reason that I focus so heavily on the use of emergency laws and the problem of the democratic deficit which has arisen through the use of these emergency regulations that don't need to be pre-approved by Parliament, is because I do appreciate, and I think get perhaps more than ever, the importance of what we call in human rights law the margin of appreciation, or subsidiarity, if you want to get it's really technical, this idea that some decisions are so big and so difficult and so impactful that they have to be made by our democratically elected leaders, or democratically elected individuals as a group, that they are ultimately democratic decisions, they're political decisions. And I know I sound a bit like a sort of policy exchange report right now about why the courts need to stop butting into political decisions. That's not what I mean. But I do think some decisions are ultimately ones which are best made by our democratic institutions. And one of the real problems of this year has been the lack of democratic accountability. State responsibility for deaths as a second issue. You know, there's some well-known issues. I think there'll be some issues that come to the fore. You know, what happened in care homes during the first lockdown, what has happened to preparation for hospital capacity, all of that side of things. One issue which I looked at quite extensively with the Joint Committee on Human Rights and drafted a bill, in fact, which never went anywhere for various reasons, was about the right to privacy and contact tracing. You know, how is all our health data being used? It's coming back It's coming back to be considered through the vaccine passports. It's kind of mark two of this contact tracing debate. You know, how much health data should the health services be holding on us, and what should they use it for? A fourth issue, discrimination. It's undoubtedly the case, and I'm sure we'll discuss this at length during today, that some parts of society who were already not doing well compared to other parts of society have done worse as a result of COVID, which is perhaps something of an inevitability when you have a health crisis such as this, because socioeconomic factors have always been part of understanding how people outcomes in healthcare. But it's one that we really need to think through and think through on quite a sort of sophisticated level. A fifth issue is the economy and the furlough scheme. I mean, this is just the most extraordinary thing that's happened. You know, the government's been paying our wages for over a year. Who would have thought that could possibly happen, and particularly under this national government? Education during lockdown, another one which I've been personally impacted on because I've got two young children who sat through the first lockdown doing absolutely nothing except watch TV. And during the second lockdown, doing quite well through their online education. But the impact of this must have just been extraordinary, not just because of the kids who have been left behind, but also the opportunities for the future. Another issue that I've been looking at a lot recently is hotel quarantine. The government, all of the governments, the national governments are running hotel detention centres for travellers, for adults and children that are going completely under the radar. And what's going on in those airport hotel detention centres is very worrying and not really being reported at the moment. Another issue, relationships. A lot of people in the country have been banned by law from having relationships during this year, whether their relationships are with people in this country, with people abroad, or in this country because they've not been able to meet up indoors to have a relationship, which has again just been mind-blowing from a human rights perspective. And who could ever have guessed that would happen? The right to the justice system. I mean, similar to the education system, what a mess this pandemic has left, increasing the delays that were already there, but also using a basically untested technology to run trials. And then the final point is vaccine passports, which I think is going to come up very soon in our national conversation about trying to come out of this crisis. Just finishing off, what went wrong? Well, I'm not actually going to go into what the government and governments have done wrong, because I think that will probably be well aired during this day. But I do want to think about that question that you were asked at the beginning. Why has there been insufficient attention paid to human rights? And I want to raise a few possibilities. On the plus side, I have seen everybody involved in human rights, every human rights organization has been working full pelt through this crisis to try and solve the problems that have arisen in whatever area that's come. And that has taken an incredible amount of creativity, not least because we've also been faced by all of the same problems that everybody in the country has had, whether through illness or through having to work from home or through having to educate our children or having to look after relatives who are unwell or vulnerable. And just to keep our heads above water during that time period has been extremely difficult. And on the plus side, there has been, just looking at it from a legal perspective, there's been a lot of success, particularly under the radar, in convincing public authorities to row back from unlawful decision making, and usually that's happened without a big sort of court judgment. It's happened through negotiation and and set an early settlement, because in actual fact, the government has been quite amenable to, and I can't speak for what's been going on in Scotland, but I can speak for what's going on in England. The government has been quite amenable to reaching settlements when it's been told there have been issues, in some cases, in others, not so much. But I think on the negative side, I do wonder if the human rights community, if there is a human rights community, if one of the issues, one of the reasons why human rights have not been, not sufficient attention has been paid to human rights, is because the human rights community itself has been unable to really present a vision of human rights which fits into this crisis. I've seen, you know, first of all, that range of approaches ranging, I guess, from libertarian to liberal to social rights to whatever, it seemed quite divided and divisive. And you've had this sort of strange alliances between, particularly in England, between the sort of libertarian anti-lockdown people and the political and civil rights defenders. And fair enough, over things like the right to protest, something that I've been working on a lot, particularly with the Reclaim These Streets case that I've been working on. But I do wonder whether it's time to think whether the vision of human rights that is sort of in the mainstream is enough to fit into this world that has been changed and illuminated by COVID. If any of you have come across, there's a historian, American historian called Sam Moyne, who M-O-Y-N, who's written a really interesting book. His last but one book was about the failure, as he sees it, of the human rights world to really embrace social and economic rights, and why that has left human rights defenders slightly on the margins of a society which is where the time for economic and social rights has really come. And I'm increasingly attracted to that idea. And I think one of the issues that I see from the human rights perspective is there hasn't been enough of a voice of this is how we can rebuild society. And I know there is Build Back Better and there is this idea and it's coming, but I think it needs to be stronger. And just the final thing I'd say, I spoke about those three spaces of human rights in culture, in institutions and in law. And I think in law, a lot of the focus in England, certainly in the last few years, has been the government's attempt at reviewing human rights and judicial review. So the legal structures which protect human rights, and doing so in a way which is, you know, is definitely not going to strengthen those structures. It will weaken them. There's no interest in strengthening them. My worry, having acted in many cases which have attempted to get COVID-related issues in front of the courts in the past year and a bit, is that in actual fact, the legal system, particularly for dealing with urgent issues relating to human rights, is not really fit for purpose. It's a mess. I've been involved in quite a few urgent cases where they're getting someone out of hotel quarantine, a disabled child, or getting people out of the Napier barracks where the Home Office was storing asylum seekers. It's the only verb that I can use is to store rather than to house. It was absolutely outrageous conditions. And also the Reclaim These Streets case, which was an attempt to, and partial success in clarifying the law relating to protest. But I think that those kind of urgent procedures are only fit to address individual issues. They're not fit to address these big issues of, you know, the government has brought in a law which bans all protest. What can we do about that in the next 3 months while it applies? You cannot think, and I think the law's just not set up for that, because no one anticipated that could happen. But it has happened, and the law has not been fit to deal with it. And I mentioned that judgment at the beginning in Scotland about religious services, which I think led to 2 days of religious services being allowed before they were going to be allowed anyway. But really, you know, there is a system in the UK which has been used to go straight to the Supreme Court for a judgment relating to the interpretation of insurance laws. Like, we've got statutes, which I didn't know about until there was a COVID case about it in the summer, which allows you to go straight to the Supreme Court for a declaratory judgment about the interpretation of insurance laws, which they did for business interruption around COVID. But it's just extraordinary. You can't do that. Go straight to the Supreme Court for a decision about whether a law banning protest, outdoor protest, or religious services, or, you know, people, you know, having relationships, these sort of basic things, that could not be analysed by the courts, which is my real critique. I think that our legal system needs strengthening, not weakening.
Thank you for listening to the Human Rights 2020s podcast. For more information about our work as Scotland's civil society network for the protection and promotion of human rights, please visit our website at www.hrcscotland.org or follow us on Twitter at HRC Scotland. Thank you.